This is a podcast from Cambridge Assessment. For more downloads, visit cambridgeassessment.org.uk.
Today's conference is going to be something of an assessment sandwich, I think, by which I mean that the filling is going to have a distinctly assessment flavour to it, but the bread that holds it together, the two keynote presentations, they're going to have an altogether different taste. Part of the aim of this conference is to help people within the field of educational assessment see broader horizons and to explore risk-related parallels from other fields. And our first speaker, Professor Alistair Scotland, is from the health sector, and he brings us insights from his experience of governance and regulation in the medical professions. Alistair graduated in medicine from Aberdeen University, becoming a surgeon and then later a plastic surgeon. He entered management in the 1980s, moving through a range of job titles in London-based jobs, from regional medical officer to medical director and director of medical education and research, before being invited to set up the National Clinical Assessment Authority in April of 2001. Alistair led the NCAA, which later became the National Clinical Assessment Service, until his retirement in August 2011. Alistair has more letters after his name than I have fingers and toes, but three which he acquired most recently were an OBE from the 2012 Birthday Honours List. Alistair is going to be speaking for about 40 minutes, and then I'll return to the stage to chair a very short, I think, question and answer session. So, Alistair, it's a pleasure to welcome you here today.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, I love to teach. I love to teach in the same way as people love to write. People like to make music and even to paint. And love is a kind of an odd word to use in that setting because it's something that makes you boil with frustration at the difference between what you're trying to achieve and what you actually achieve, that makes you snap your colleagues' noses off and kick the dog. But I can never remember a time when I did not love the world of teaching and education. I had my first experience of teacher training just before my 8th birthday, when I started tagging along with my father and mother, when my father, twice a year, used to lead training conferences, training workshops in Shakespeare in Stratford-on-Avon. And we used to spend a week in workshops, acting practice, all of that stuff, learning about teaching Shakespeare. And it was punctuated by, in that first year, watching Charles Laughton play Bottom, watching Laurence Olivier play Coriolanus, and watching Paul Robeson play Othello. That was intensified by my father's out-of-hours work, which was very much about the boards of the stage. It was about writing for the radio and for the television. And so when I was not steeped in teacher education, I was either in the wings, on the stage, or in the audience. So, ladies and gentlemen, I love to teach. Now, I'm looking around all of you, and you're all thinking, this is more information than I need. But the point is, and I want you to hold this in your mind, that my love of teaching and education is exactly that. I am an amateur. The overwhelming majority of you here today are professionals. And that distinction will lie at the heart of everything I'm going to say today. Now, my task today is to set out my perspective on the current debate about regulation and governance. And I've divided our drama into five acts. And as you can see, they are laid out there. The first one, which we are in at the moment, is a little bit more about me, very little, but more about the importance of this and the breadth of this as a topic across society, not just across my own industry of health, but also of all the other industries that we are involved in. Secondly, I'm going to do a bit on the history and inheritance of the field. Then I'm going to talk a bit about what I see as a perfect storm that we have been through in my industry, but I think it has affected most of the public sector industries and indeed more recently some of the very commercial sector industries. The fourth act is about where I think we might go, and with one sting in the tail, one warning about it, and then finally I will review it. Now, a bit more about that first act. Well, as you can see, I've spent my career in medicine. You've heard about that. And I won't presume to reinterpret what I say today for the world of education. Now, the reason I'm doing that is twofold. Firstly, I'm an amateur, and therefore if I tried, I'd get it wrong. But secondly, and more to the point, an audience this size is diverse. And so if I successfully reinterpret for one group, I will not for another. But I'm hoping that what I say will have some resonance. So, the world of governance and the world of regulation can seem arcane to the public. And that there are good reasons for that, because essentially regulation is about worlds which are focused on very complex activities, highly developed activities. They are not easily accessible to the public. But of course, when things go wrong, that set of characteristics does not mean that it is not very easily understood and that the consequences are not profound. And I've got three examples here of something that was very profound, but in a very complex area. In 1983, in a quiet and affluent suburb of Aberdeen, the residents in this hotel were sitting having breakfast when an explosion in the kitchen tore off the front of the hotel, destroyed the roof, and took the dining room down into the basement kitchens. A large number of people were killed. And the point about it was that there was clear knowledge of what the problem was, but Scottish Gas admitted later that it simply decided not to carry out the relevant modifications because they were too expensive. Eventually, they realised they should do it, and they ordered that thing there, which we all now have on our gas meters, those of us who have gas. It's called the gas governor. That's my first one. This is Hurricane Katrina. 7 years ago, it slammed into New Orleans. The importance of putting it here, that, by the way, is the water pouring over the levees. The importance of this is that little report in the bottom right-hand corner there. Essentially, in the wake of it, a very significant number of medical practitioners who had been struck off presented themselves, claiming to be fully registered medical practitioners, to help. They were banking on the fact that their records had been destroyed in the flood, and that that was a way of getting back onto the register. And in the northwest of England, over a period of 23 years, a much-loved local GP is estimated to have killed at least 215 of his patients. Now, the point of putting those forward is that all three of those are about an actual or potential failure in governance. The first one I've explained. The second one, which was a near miss, was about an attempt to circumvent proper controls. And the third, it was a repeated cynical abuse of a power gradient. But what also connects them, of course, is tragedy. I made the point earlier about the profound nature of a failure of regulation, a failure of governance, the really immediate impact it has on people. The tragedy that connects these, I was always brought up in that Greek tradition, that the tragedy, or at least the seeds of it, lie in the flaw, and the flaw is what I will be talking about. So, moving on to a bit more of the theory, and I should at this point say that some of what I will say will sound a bit like one of those 1950s dance classes. Slow, slow, quick, quick, slow. So some of this I will move rather more rapidly than others, but I have said to the organisers that if anyone here would like a copy of the slides that I've put up, I'm more than happy for them to have it. Everything I say either is already in the public domain or by the time I'm finished will be. So the history of governance in individual practice essentially is steeped in the history of professionalism. And if you actually go through the literature, you effectively come up with three features which describe professionalism. And I don't believe it's anything to do with just being a doctor or a teacher or an examiner, anything else. The first one is that there is a specialised knowledge, a highly technical knowledge. And the purpose of that is to enable those three things that I've set out there, to know what to do, to be able to justify it, and to do it safely. Secondly, that there is a socially approved self-governance. And this is a crucial one for the whole of the issue that I'm going to be talking about. And thirdly, and very importantly, commitment to service and devotion to the public good. And of course, that third one takes you quite quickly, in the case of my own profession, to the Hippocratic Oath or something equivalent to it. What it produces, of course, is an idea that the professions and the arena that the professions work in are altruistic and they are value-laden. But it does also take you, in some of the literature, to some of the debate that leads to the George Bernard Shaw comment that all professions are conspiracies against the laity, that there is a use of this obscurity, this arcaneness. There is a use of that in order to produce a blank screen between the public and yourself. So, what then arises is what is the nature of being a professional? And in my world, the two best writers are Richard and Sylvia Cruz. They have been writing for very many decades now. They're now well into their 90s, but still very active. Have described two quite distinct but overlapping roles. One is the healer, if you like, the practitioner, and the other one is the professional. And the best way of describing the distinction between the two is something you very often hear in my world, and I suspect you hear in the world of education as well. It's a statement like along the lines of, I just want to treat patients, or I just want to teach students, or, you know, whatever. I can't be bothered with all this bureaucracy. Now, the difficulty is that if you want to be a professional, you have to do the other stuff. It's all right for the healer or the practitioner just to do one bit, but the professional needs to do the lot. So, moving on from that, if you start to look at what regulation is about, you can pull together essentially three sets of things. The first one is the purposes of regulation. Then you get into the criteria by which you would select something for regulation. And then finally, something that describes the way they work. So if we stick first with the purposes of regulation, essentially they are fourfold. And I would argue the latter two very much bring in a strand that I haven't yet picked up and I won't spend a lot of time on today. Because what I've talked about so far is very much the world of quality regulation. But of course, there's a completely separate strand of market regulation, which is as important. The principles are identical between the two, but I will devote most of what I talk about to the world of quality regulation because that is the one that operates most forcibly in the health industry. But essentially the purposes, why you regulate. Firstly, it is about protecting the knowledge base. Secondly, it's about maintaining competence and teaching it in people who want to be part of that setup. Thirdly, it's about protecting the consumer, the devotion to the public good. And fourth, it's about ensuring the fair operation of the market. So why would we select someone for a regulated activity or something for a regulated activity? And essentially, there are two sets of criteria that I would argue need to be applied if you look at the literature. The first is this thing I've kept going on about, the obscurity of what you are doing to society. And the second one, and this is importantly entangled with the first one, is that the oversight of that activity, whether that is a market-regulated activity or a quality-regulated activity, the oversight, it is impracticable to achieve either through a relevant legal code or through relying on market forces. Now, I'm going to come back to that later because this can become really quite an important element of the elephant trap that I will talk about at the end. And to telegraph that right up front, the elephant trap I will be talking about is inappropriate external influence on a regulated industry. So those are the criteria for selection. And the third group is how do they work? And that essentially is about a set of rules. This is not a blinding insight. But the important bit is that it's in the context of the law. It is, by definition, subsidiary to the law. And secondly, that the enforcement feels a bit like the law. Now, on that slide, essentially, is regulation. If you can make your way through that slide, then you will get a feel for why we do it, what it is we do, and how it is that we do it. So, the real test, however, and that's, if you like, that's the theory. The real test of regulation is how does it work in practice? And from this point of view, this is where I move into saying the gold standard of any regulated activity is that it picks up the remarks we had at the beginning, that there is an ability to predict, to prevent, to identify, and to manage when things go wrong. Of course, regulation is much more broadly based than that, and it does a lot more than that. It's very much about the whole of that particular activity. But the real bottom line for the success of any regulated activity is if it can achieve, if it can set up an environment in which those four things can be successfully achieved. Prediction, prevention, identification, and management of the untoward. Now, this is where I move into, if you like, systems that we have in place to assure governance. These come from my world of the health industry. I believe they can be more broadly set. And the first of the three worlds of governance, if you like, the three estates of governance, are about being equipped for practice. This is about capability. This is the world of the universities, the world in my world of medical schools, of postgraduate deans, of directors of medical education. I know Diana's here today. This is all about assessment. This is the world of educational appraisal. And as I say, this is about assuring the capability of the field. The second one is about delivery. This is about being fit for purpose. This is the world of management. This is the world of organisational delivery. This is the world of individual performance review. And the third one is the world of ethics, the ethical basis of practice. This is the world of the professional regulators. In terms of my world, it is the plethora of professional regulators in health, but there are also the various general teaching councils, whether they still exist or don't, and I will come back to that phenomenon as well. And this is about licensure and relicensure. It's about having a franchise to deliver if you're an organisation and so forth. So essentially, these are about capability, about delivery, and about ethics. And these essentially are the vehicles, the tools that are used. So what mechanisms might we use for identifying underperformance? Well, I've talked about those three, and I won't talk any more about them. But the second group is actually, what are the self-righting mechanisms that are in place? I've talked about the theory, the regulatory stratosphere, the national bodies that exist and the national architecture. But actually, that's only one of what I would call the four levels of regulation. This is a widely recognised analysis in a number of different arenas. But it starts with true, and I would argue unique, self-regulation. This is the individual knowing their own boundaries, wanting to stretch them, but staying within them. But there's also team regulation. That's caring for each other, acting as the critical friend, and so forth. Organisational regulation, which is about the entire organisation that you're part of, in health, the health economy you're part of, the educational economy you're part of. And then finally, the bit I have been talking about so far, statutory regulation. But how do we get concern? I would argue there are three sources, and they're all as important as each other. Possibly the first is the most important, self-regulation. The little voice that tells you somebody might be looking, as H.L. Mencken said. Then there's the consumers. We have to listen to them. We have to pay attention to them. We are notorious in the health industry for not paying attention to the consumers, either the patient or the carer. And then finally, there are the colleagues. They're often the loudest and often the least effective. In my world, I very often see situations where posses of consultants will stomp about a hospital saying something must be done. And when one says, fine, now would you kindly tell me what the problem is, they melt away like, as they say in my part of the world, snow off a dike. So those are the mechanisms. That, as I say, is the theory, and that is how it should work. Now we move on to Act 3. We're at the midpoint. And I would argue that we've seen the development of regulatory structures. The structures themselves really started in the mid-19th century, and they started as a direct consequence of the heavy development of professionalism through the Industrial Revolution. There was a lot of opposition to their introduction, and there was a lot of opposition because of what I've been alluding to, the notion that we don't like to be challenged. But the fact is they came in, there was an enormous expansion in them, and particularly those of us of a certain age here grew up with quite a complex environment, regulatory environment in which to work. It all started to seem to go wrong in the late 1980s and early 1990s, but I would argue the seeds of that were sown a great deal earlier. I would actually argue that they were sown paradoxically by the welfare state reforms immediately after the Second World War. That was the world I grew up in, and it was one we felt very safe in. The state will manage. The state will do it. But what I've talked about up till now is a contract between an industry or between an individual or between a profession and society at large, with the management of that contract being in order to take away from the public at large the challenge of managing something it found difficult to understand or was not easily accessible. I would argue that the welfare state reforms at the end of the Second World War actually started to introduce a wedge between the public at large and the professions, the industries that were being regulated. And I think it was in part because of what I've just said, this business of the state will provide. But I think also there was a sense of a falling off in that commitment to public service among the professions generally. So what that moved on to, and I suppose one should have seen that an early example of it. I talked earlier about my family background in teacher education. My father was very much involved in the group that set up the General Teaching Council for Scotland, which was the first of its type anywhere. Indeed, he was seen as one of the prime movers. There were some who were quite implacably opposed to it, and one particular high-profile individual who marshalled arguments that really very firmly gave you an idea that this person did not see themselves as having any accountability to the public for what they were delivering, got so frustrated with the relentless progress towards the introduction of the General Teaching Council for Scotland that I can still remember when he had one day, at his own expense, had a full ton of fresh, steaming horse manure delivered to our back garden. Which sight met me rather later than the smell, arriving home from school. My father was understandably distressed about this, and he said, "Oh, Jean, we're really going to have to do something about this." "Too right," she said, as she strode past him in a pair of Wellington Boots gardening clothes, brandishing a fork and a beaming smile. They were the best roses and fruit we ever had. The point of the story, however, is not that. It is that it was quite striking that there was a significant minority who were starting to lose sight of that contract. So, how it happened in medicine, and this is where I'm going to go very much into the health sector, was that in the 1990s we had a governance crisis. It had four features, and I think they do have resonance, but they are very much about my world. The first was we were tolerating poor performance, and I will challenge everyone in this room to put up a hand if they have never been in the situation where they've seen something in their world which was not right, and they did nothing about it. Second, we kept doing it. It kept happening. We've heard more eloquently and more concisely than I can ever do the challenge on patient safety that the health service faces. And the biggest challenge it has was it just keeps happening. We didn't seem to learn. Thirdly, we did not have good systems for responding. Highly adversarial, not surprising given everything I've said so far. And lastly, we had the glories of the media, which of course overwhelmingly focused on blame, finding someone to kick around the front pages. And the point of that was it made it very difficult to have a proper debate about the real issues that are going on. And if anything is resonant for the issues that are facing education and assessment today, that last one, for me, is the most important. So what did we do? Well, first of all, what did that mean? Well, over on the left there, you see the victim of the patient safety incident. You see the family, rather upset about it all, and the person bottom left, I think, is probably the local chief executive, who is finding it very difficult indeed to talk to anyone. A little bit later, the lawyer arrives and instructs three barristers, and nobody is yet talking to the family. And for the staff... So what about the response? Well, this essentially was a three-phase approach to reform. I'm going to skate through these fairly quickly, but there are some important elements to it. Essentially, the first thing was making accountability for the quality as well as the market, the financial regulation of the health sector, making that centre stage. So it brought together market regulation and quality regulation in health. And chief executives feel very accountable, despite what a lot of my colleagues in the medical profession think. There were a lot of underpinning bodies that were introduced at that point, and that's an important point as well. Mine is somewhere in there. The second group was a modernisation of modern HR practice, and the third was a reformed professional regulation. The first is key. Unless you get accountability sorted, nothing else will work. And I will keep coming back to that point. But the point was, what that then felt like was like that. These are all bodies in the health sector that see themselves as having some responsibility for the quality of care at local level. And it really can feel bewildering and oppressive. Now, how have we done to meet this challenge? Essentially, those are the three things I want to apply to see whether we've actually succeeded or not. The first is there evidence that the public is more assured? That's the purpose of regulation. It is about managing a social contract on behalf of the public. So are the public more assured? Point two, are the problems that were coming up in the 90s, the 80s and 90s, is there any evidence they're lessening? And can we do it at a reasonable amount of money? Professional governance, this is the GMC, the GDC, all those acronyms which are essentially about the different professions in health. Well, actually, qualified rapture, modified rapture, this isn't bad. It's a lot better. The shift in the debate from the late 80s, early 90s about named people who were seen as being the focus of the problem It's now about systems. That has an inherent problem built into it, which I'll come back to. And I've put some evidence there. I won't explore it in detail, but essentially there is some clear, hard evidence that the world there is getting better. But the fault lines are there, and they're still there, and there is an inadequate integration across the field. Please think of that in terms of your own world. What about systems governance? Well, no, this is nothing like as good. The problem here, in professional governance, a single bad failure can hit the headlines big time. In systems failure, it's repeated failure that will actually get you into the press. And the impact of the changes, much less clear. We're still seeing the scandals coming forward. At the moment, there's a very big one in my world about the Mid-Staffordshire hospitals, where over years there were sustained poor outcomes, very much along the lines we were hearing earlier on. And it's still coming forward. The fault lines are still there. There is poor integration. And that leads directly, with poor integration, the first thing that goes wrong is whistleblowing. People respond to whistleblowing not at all well. Do the dogs bark? If they do, what happens? And at Mid-Staffordshire, my colleague Robert Francis, who is chairing that inquiry, the question he was asking right at the start was, why didn't the dogs bark? By the time I got to give evidence, the question he was asking was, the dogs were barking. Why was no one listening? Because they were barking in all the right directions. So what went wrong? Well, my colleague Cyril Chantler essentially said that once, and it's a very powerful statement. Modern medicine used to be ineffective and safe. Now it is very effective, it's very high in its impact, and it's very unsafe. It's a huge challenge. And the difficulty is, over my career, what I have perceived is it's a bit like electing a politician. You elect politicians on the basis of a fantasy. You don't elect them for their track record. You elect them because you think they'll reduce your tax bill. So you elect someone on the basis of a fantastic future. And the problem is that that's what happens when these arm's-length bodies are created. They are created on the basis of a fantasy. And when that fantasy isn't delivered, because they have no existence outside of political whim, is they tend to be either reconfigured or actually abolished without any analysis of why the fantasy wasn't delivered. Was it a reasonable fantasy in the first place, and how were you measuring it? And so why is there a problem? Well, that summarises it. Point one, I've said it's busy, the landscape. Two, it doesn't reflect local practice. We still regulate according to a traditional retrospective approach to the way the world of that service, that industry, is designed. And of course, we're comfortable with silos. So doctors will regulate doctors, nurses will regulate nurses, teachers will regulate teachers, and so examiners will regulate examiners, and so forth. But there's a third one, which I find quite pernicious, and it's very, very much the case in health, which is what I would call a sort of organisational snobbery, which can feel a bit like one of those German royal weddings of the turn of the 20th century. You know, can an elector speak to anyone other than an archduke? What kind of duke are you? Are you a duke of or a duke in? And does that make a difference to who I can speak to? That's what it can feel like in the health service. The current chief executive of the GMC said to me once despairingly, he said, going in through the door, you get this sense of we're the GMC. Now, well, yes, that's what it says on the door. But of course, there is that sense that he was railing against, that in some way it had a special status and could only deal upwards or sideways and never what it saw as downwards. And without a duty of cooperation, there is a big problem. So, how do we make it better? This is just a summary of what I've said so far. I'm not going to go through the slide, but if you like, I could have used it and substituted it for a lot of the earlier ones. Now, these are the challenges that I think we've got to try and deal with. I've said that the social contract appears to be compromised. It isn't as strong. It's not entirely clear why it isn't as strong. I've suggested why. The regulatory landscape at the moment is seen to be ineffective. It's oppressive, it's fragmented, and it doesn't reflect local practice. There is a lack of effective cooperation. I've suggested one of the reasons why that is. Another colleague who's here today has described it as being a bit like the operation of a soap opera. And I think that also fits with it. There is also a poor or absent collaboration with non-regulatory. In other words, this world isn't just about statutory regulation. There's a lot of other organisations that underpin the quality and the quality of the market in which we work. And we need all to be working properly together. And then, of course, finally, there is a flavour of the political football around all of this. So, what do we need? We need a simpler landscape. And my first point would be that we only should regulate where we meet the criteria I set out earlier. And actually, if we just do that inflation deflation of arm's length bodies all the time, then actually we're making a mockery of the market forces, and we're making a mockery of the law. I'm going to test that. The odd one out round. Which of these five people do you think is the odd one out? There we have Sir Lancelot Spratt, James Robertson Justice, of course. This is the medical profession. This is the health industry. And there we have Dr. Alex Smart of Narcover School, the world of education. And here we have the head of Gringotts Wizarding Bank. That's better. And there we have stipendiary magistrate Swallow, Alistair Sim, from Misleading Cases. There we have the law. And there we have Charles Foster Kane, the media... Charles Foster Kane, the media mogul. You are absolutely right. The odd one out is the last one. The news media do not meet the criteria that I've set out this morning. So in my view, it is wrong to regulate them. We should simply use the law. So what do we need? That's the first one. The second one, regulatory structures need to reflect local practice. And I've asked the question there. In my industry, we have 10 bodies that see themselves as having a statutory role in the regulation of healthcare staff. That's bonkers. Step one, we need to have a single regulator, but we need to reflect that in the systems regulator. We've got a series of regulators that do systems in health as well. That makes no sense. So step two, they need to be unified. And step three, perhaps we have a single regulator for health. We also need a properly integrated approach. I would argue that we need a legally binding duty of cooperation. If you want to be in the field of regulation or governance support, you need to come under the umbrella of a binding duty of cooperation, which is blind to your status. Remember my point about organisational snobbery. And it actually includes that last point, that you've got to open the books. An elephant trap. This is the question of inappropriate external influence. We've all seen it. It naturally happens. It's one of those instincts that everyone has. Essentially, inappropriate political influence, and I use it with both a large and a small p, is easier to handle. It's easier to see it happen, shall we say. Essentially, if those two sets of bullet points there, the first two sub-bullet points operate, i.e., firstly, if we're not sufficiently rigorous about deciding what we are regulating, secondly, that there isn't a justification for any other body that's there, and thirdly, that they don't work effectively together. And you need that to make sure it is working properly. The tighter and more effective it is, the less likely it is for the political algorithms of the time. In other words, if it isn't entirely clear why those people are there and why they're working together, given that they are subsidiary to the law, then it is very much more easy for their actions to be influenced inappropriately. The best way, I think, of illustrating this is a particular anecdote, which I'm sure is true. Some here, like me, are old enough to remember Her Majesty's Inspectors of Schools. Of course, they're Ofsted inspectors down here now. But some years ago, actually some decades ago, one particular HMI who was very, very proud of his teaching prowess, many decades as a teacher of religious education, was doing one such inspection. And he used to enjoy himself by adding to the to the whole experience by engaging with the school students. And he said to one particularly bright young man, he said, tell me, Smith, who blew down the walls of Jericho? Smith looked up and said, please, sir, it wasn't me, sir. You can imagine he was a bit disappointed by this, and he went to see the head teacher and told the story, and she looked suitably grave and said, well, I know Smith, and if he said he didn't do it, he didn't do it. We can imagine the consternation at this point. And when he got back to base, he went to see the local director of education, went into his office, asked to see him, went into his office, told the whole sorry state. Guy there took off his glasses, put his head in his hands, and said, well, let's not make too much fuss about it. Just find out what it cost and we'll write a cheque and that'll be the end of it. So, ladies and gentlemen, that is essentially what I have suggested we need into the future. Everything I've said here, down as far as moving upstream, is summarised in the other slides. Those last two are, firstly, we need to move upstream. Today is about moving upstream. Today is about risk. And risk is about the predictive end, the preventive end, and the early identification end. It's also about the management of those situations. And so we need what I've set out there. Sensitive, specific systems. So they're sensitive enough to pick everything up and specific enough to know what's important. But also please note that if you identify failure early, it is unlikely to have breached the standard below which nothing must fall. It's likely to have breached a target. Lastly, it can be done light touch with frameworks and binding rules. And if we get it right, can we avoid that? And can we also avoid that? That cold, remote, arcane image. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for listening.
This is a podcast from Cambridge Assessment. For more downloads, visit cambridgeassessment.org.uk.